Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The legendary American basketball coach John Wooden once said, "Be more concerned about your character than your reputation, because your character is what you really are, while your reputation is merely what others think you are." Add that to what Abraham Lincoln said: if you want to test a man's character, give him power. And when you do that, you have a scale by which you can measure the character of our leaders and the importance they place upon it. Character and leadership were always thought to go hand in hand in American culture. Great leaders, great presidents were those we thought of as being people of character. But of late, there are those who would say that doesn't seem to matter anymore. Perhaps they are wrong. Perhaps a look back on some former presidents and the role that character played in their presidencies might remind us of the role it can play in our politics and our nation as a whole. Mark Updegrove is a presidential historian and author of 6 books on the presidency. Today he serves as president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation and is the presidential historian for ABC News, as well as the host of the PBS series Live from the LBJ Library with Mark Updegrove. His latest book is Make Your Mark, Lessons in Character from 7 Presidents, and he joins us now to tell us more. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Delighted to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So in this book, on character in various presidents, you profile 7 recent holders of that office: Gerald Ford, moving on to Jimmy Carter, on to Ronald Reagan, both Presidents Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. But as I said, you're the CEO of the LBJ Foundation and previously the director of the LBJ Presidential Library, and you've written in the past about JFK. Why aren't they in the book?
Well, these are presidents that I've known and interviewed. I never interviewed JFK nor LBJ, but I knew Gerald Ford. I knew Jimmy Carter. I did not know Ronald Reagan well, but I was around Reagan and knew George Bush, all of them forward. And so I spent time with them, and I really got a sense of their character by interviewing them. I hosted all of them. So I got a sense of who they were and how various character traits imbued their legacy. The inevitable question, Mike, will be, why didn't I write about Joe Biden and Donald Trump? I
have. That was my next question.
Well, it's like a good interviewer. I have interviewed Joe Biden. I have not interviewed, nor have I met Donald Trump. The reason I didn't write about them is because their legacies were in the balance. When I delivered this book, Joe Biden was still president. His legacy was still very much in the balance. And given what we have learned about Joe Biden subsequent to his presidency, we really didn't have a solid look at what history would ultimately say about him.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump was politically viable. He was the Republican candidate for the presidency again, despite long odds. And again, I didn't know him. And I think a character sketch on Donald Trump would be problematic anyway.
The presidents that you profile in this book, I've named them all, are both Republicans and Democrats, and they're all fairly recent. So I guess some of their rough edges still remain. They haven't been rubbed off by history. But we live in these highly polarized times when Democrats don't speak to Republicans and vice versa, and the other side is the enemy, and everybody thinks of everybody as being partisan. How do you write fairly about these presidents in modern times, who are both Democrats and Republicans, in an unbiased way, in a fair way? How do you do it?
Well, I would challenge anyone to read the book to see if I've passed the test, but I think I'm looking at the character traits again that I think inform their legacies and inform the decisions they made while they were presidents that led to those legacies. But you know, I don't really dwell on the negative. I look at the most positive aspects of who these presidents were, and again, as it relates to how that quality informed the policy of their administration. So there's one story, Mike, that illustrates how different things are today than they were half a century ago. And it relates to Gerald Ford, the first president I ever interviewed and the first one I cover in this book. And it's the day before he grants the pardon to Richard Nixon, which he extends a month after taking the presidency. He knows it's going to be controversial. And he meets with his old friend from the House of Representatives, Tip O'Neill. And he tells Tip O'Neill, a staunch Democrat, very liberal, very different from Gerald Ford in terms of his politics. And he tells O'Neill that he's going to grant the pardon. And O'Neill says, Jerry, don't do it. You'll lose the election, by which he meant earning the presidency in his own right in 1976. Yeah. And this is a Democrat telling his friend not to do it because it'll hurt him politically. And Ford says, yeah, Tip, I know, but it's the right thing to do. And of course, Gerald Ford would lose the election in 1976 to Jimmy Carter. But again, it speaks to the relationships the Democrats and Republicans once had.
I was going to ask you a question about Gerald Ford and his pardon of Richard Nixon, because when he was vice president and the investigation into Nixon was ongoing, he was asked about the possibility of a presidential pardon should he assume that office at some point. And he said, I don't think the public would stand for it. And as you point out, when he became the president upon Richard Nixon's resignation, he had to decide what to do about Nixon. And he issued a full, free, and absolute pardon, saying that it felt right in his heart, as you write in your book, and that he couldn't rely on opinion polls. He had to do what he felt was right. What does that say about his character? Because he changed his mind on this. We used to criticize presidents for flip-flopping or politicians for flip-flopping. We don't do that anymore. But was that a display of character in your mind?
It was, but you have to remember what he said was, I don't think the American people would stand for it. He was right. The American people didn't stand for it. But that didn't mean he didn't think it was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do. And let me just give context, Mike. He believed that as long as the legal fate of Richard Nixon hung over the country, we wouldn't move on to more pressing issues. It was too divisive an issue. And we see divisions today that were very reminiscent of those that we saw from Nixon in the mid-1970s. But he did it because we weren't addressing the major issues that were holding us back, a lingering war in Vietnam, the quagmire of Vietnam, and stagflation, a stagnant economy along with hyperinflation. And I think pardoning Nixon did remove that from the equation. We got it behind us.
I'm going to ask you this. It's a little off topic, but you're an historian. Did he make the right decision? Because there are those who say that because he pardoned Nixon, because Nixon got away with things that in retrospect are perhaps less serious than some of the things that we were investigating Donald Trump at the end of his first presidency, it set Trump up for being able to do what he's done. And if we had punished Richard Nixon, perhaps that would have stopped all this.
You can't know what history will hold. You can't know what the future will hold. You just can't know that. You have to do what's right in your time. And you couldn't foresee a Donald Trump. Who could? I mean, my gosh, if you asked me 20 years ago, could Donald Trump emerge to become president of the United States? And would he do these certain things? I would have thought that was utterly preposterous. I think we have to do what's right in our time. As Harry Truman used to say, do your best and let history do the rest. So you can't anticipate that. I've talked to Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein about this, and they feel the same way. You got to do what's right for your time. That was the right thing to do. And to your point, Micah, a very politically courageous thing to do.
I know your book doesn't, it starts with Gerald Ford, does not start with Richard Nixon, and Ford comes to the White House because of Richard Nixon. But Nixon did accomplish some fairly important things in his presidency. He was a terribly flawed individual, and it was his Watergate dealings and the fact that he taped these conversations that were eventually released that brought him down. How would you characterize Nixon and his character and his presidency?
You know, a mixed bag. I start the book with Clare Boothe Luce, who used to lecture presidents. You'll be remembered in one sentence, she used to say to presidents. What will be your sentence? And my argument is that those sentences are underscored by character traits that inform us who these presidents were. I think for Richard Nixon, she say with Nixon, she said they will say of Richard Nixon, Richard Nixon, he went to China. And after he resigned, he said, you know, no, it will be Richard Nixon. He was the first president to resign the presidency. In fact, it's both. And both of those sentences really reflect Nixon's character. Here's somebody on the Watergate side who was willing to do what, you know, he was willing to break the law in order to retain presidential power. On the other hand, he's the one who went to China, this bold foreign policy visionary who saw an opportunity to open China and change the dynamic in the Cold War. So he was both. He was a very complicated individual, but the bad parts of his character were consequential. They're the reasons that he resigned the presidency.
We have two examples of Republicans who seem to be willing to do to go to great lengths, let's put it that way, to hold on to power, Richard Nixon and Donald Trump at the end of his first term in office. But then we have people who are criticizing Donald Trump for the way he talks and the way he deals with other people in our own country, our own political structure, and elsewhere around the world. But as the CEO of the LBJ Library, LBJ was known to strong arm people behind the scenes as well. Perhaps he didn't disparage them in public quite as badly as Trump does, but behind the scenes, he was known to be fairly scary. Are there similarities there?
I don't think so. I mean, both wielded power effectively, but Lyndon Johnson did so within the bounds of the Constitution. He observed democratic norms. He was one who was trying to promote democracy. The Voting Rights Act is a very good example of that. So this is somebody who was never, never encouraged his supporters to rise up and storm the Capitol if things weren't going his way. There are tremendous differences between the two. Lyndon Johnson angelic? No, nobody who wields power in the manner that Lyndon Johnson did is angelic. Did he love his country? Did he put its interests above his own? Did he do his best? Yes. And I would argue that those things are the most that we can expect of any presence, and we should demand it.
And I was going to ask you about that too, because in these profiles, you say at their best, these presidents made their mark by reflecting the values that we aspire to as a nation. Each loved our country, put its interest above his own, and did his best. We can ask for little more. And I was going to say, I think we should expect nothing less than that of our presidents. But half of our country voted for a man that the other half does not believe embodies any of those qualities. One side is wrong. So what does that say about our character as a nation?
Well, I unfortunately, to my mind, it doesn't say the right things about our character as a nation. I think Donald Trump is a great salesman, and I don't think he lives up to the criteria that I talked about. But let me just say before I answer that, Mike, I think it's a remarkable thing that by and large, most of our president have met that criteria. That's pretty, and I've never taken that for granted, even before there was a Donald Trump. I never took for granted that somebody would take that office and feel the weight of the office and rise to the occasion. I don't think that Donald Trump is temperamentally, constitutionally capable of putting anything above himself. And you don't have to go beyond January 6th to see the flaws in Donald's character and his incapability of thinking about anything.
We have to take a break. John Updegrove is our guest. He's the president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation, presidential historian for ABC News, among many other things. And his latest book is called Make Your Mark. It's about seven presidents, which we will talk about when we.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Mark Updegrove. I misspoke a moment ago. Sorry, Mark. He's the presidential historian for ABC News, author of seven books, the latest of which is called Make Your Mark, Lessons in Character from Seven Presidents. You say in this book that in leadership, character matters above all. Things are happening, and this is about presidents, but we have leaders at various different levels in this country, all the way down to dog catcher. Things are happening in America today that have been described as unprecedented, repeatedly, and worse, as un-American. And they are being perpetrated by a leader who appears to operate unilaterally, while Congress is AWOL. Some have questioned his character, but character seems to be missing in many of our leaders who have remained silent in the face of some of the things that this president has tried to do and is doing. Do we have a character problem among the leadership class in the United States today?
I think we do now, yes. I think there's no question about that. You can see that, to your point, Mike, in the fealty that our congressional Republicans in particular, you know, extend toward Donald Trump. There is no voice of dissent. Their policy simply seems to be in Trump we trust. That's it. And I do think that that's problematic. I mean, we saw the death of Dick Cheney recently, and Dick Cheney, who was, a very rightward leaning, was staunchly opposed to the autocratic instincts of Donald Trump. And we see no resistance within the party, with the exception in the first term of a few Republicans, including Cheney's daughter, Liz Cheney, who said, this is not who we are. I would hope that Republicans who have been elected to office would understand what a democratic republic is and see how Donald Trump is violating the basic tenets of who we are as a country, and we're simply not seeing it.
But it's not just members of Congress. We're watching around the country Republican-led legislatures, and both parties gerrymander. They've historically always gerrymandered, and to be clear, political gerrymandering is still, according to the Supreme Court, absolutely legal. But they are taking steps to ensure that they maintain control of the Congress in the midterm, something that the party in the White House generally loses. And they're taking these steps at the expense, it seems to me, of the American people. Because if we elect our leaders, then the leaders shouldn't be the ones electing the voters. And that's what's happening here. So are they displaying what has happened in this country that democracy, it seems to be, we're willing to throw it out with the bathwater? And is that a lack of character? Is it just a desire for power and control? Is it because we're so deeply divided that my way must be the only way, so get out of the way? And if that's the case, where are we?
I think it's all the above. I mean, it depends on who you talk to. But I think we are hopelessly, intractably divided in this moment in time. And that's unfortunate. Again, what we are not seeing from our leaders right now is them putting something above themselves. They're thinking about their own power. That's why the Republicans are doing the bidding of Donald Trump, because if they dissent in any manner, they risk being primaried and they risk losing their position of political power.
To my mind, lose.
Well, yeah, I agree. Why aren't more, in your very state, you have somebody who said, you know what, this is, I'm done with this, right? And decided to that it wasn't going to be for him anymore. I would like to see a little bit more dissent from him as a consequence of moving aside. That would be that you are essentially liberated if you make that decision.
I was going to talk about this later. We'll talk about it now. Former presidents don't generally comment on the current occupant of the office out of deference, because there's only one president at a time in this country, and that person has to have enough leash to do what they believe it in the moment needs to be done. So they don't really comment. But what's going on now is so extraordinary that President Obama has taken to the stump to campaign for Democrats and severely criticized the current occupant of the Oval Office. President Bush has been conspicuously silent on this. Why?
Well, he's spoken up at times, at certain times, never in combating Trump, never taking on Trump directly. But you can infer, you can read between the lines that he disagrees with policy. I think for a couple of reasons. Number one,
But wouldn't it be helpful and a display of character for somebody who held that office for 8 years, whose father held the office for 4 years and was vice president of the United States and a United States senator and a veteran? Wouldn't it be valuable for him to be more vocal on this?
Well, let me tell you why he does not do it as often as he might. Number one, I think he is still instrumental behind the scenes in helping certain Republicans, rather, get elected. He's still doing fundraisers. He's still doing events for certain Republicans. He would lose that ability if he squared off directly against Trump. And the other thing is, he realizes he called himself. This is the title to a book that I wrote with his and his father's cooperation called The Last Republicans. He thought when Donald Trump was the nominee of the party in 2016 that he might be, in his words, the last Republican president. He realizes that his politics, his Republican politics, is desperately out of fashion in the Republican Party. And if you look at the policies of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, they are antithetical to the policies of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is anti-immigrant. But all the both Bushes and Ronald Reagan were pro-immigrant. They were pro-democracy. They promoted democracy in the world. They were free trade presidents, right? There are all these things that are antithetical to who Donald Trump is. So he realizes that, yes, while he might be a former Republican president, he simply doesn't have a voice in that party as he once did, Mike.
Let's talk about some of the presidents that you profile in Make Your Mark, Lessons in Character from Seven Presidents. And you start the book, as we've said, with Gerald Ford, the only unelected president and a selected vice president upon the resignation of Spiro Agnew during the Nixon administration. He was unable to win the presidency for a second term in office, or his own term in office, because of his pardon of Richard Nixon, in large part. Your sentence for, and you have sentences that describe each of these presidents. Your sentence for Ford focuses on his, quote, instinct to do the right thing in the wake of Watergate. For those who remember Watergate, it seems to pale in comparison to some of the things happening in contemporary presidential history at the moment. And for those who weren't alive during Watergate, that might as well be Waterloo. That's as much ancient history as it is. But give us a sense of President Ford's character and how it was forged.
He grew up in Grand Rapids, middle-class family who encouraged him to work hard and think about the greater good. And Gerald Ford was just a good, solid Midwestern guy. He did not have presidential ambitions when he went to Washington. His greatest ambition, I think, initially was to be the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Then he had ambitions to be the vice president. Nixon turned him down twice in 1960 and in 1968. But when Spiro Agnew resigned amidst charges of that he accepted bribes dating back to his days as Maryland governor, it was congressional Republicans who told Nixon that they should appoint that he should appoint Gerald Ford as his vice president. This was at a time when we had passed the 25th Amendment to the Constitution that allowed for the appointment of a vice president in the event that that position was vacated. That was the case. It was congressional Republicans who said to Nixon, "He is our Gerald Ford is our guy." And reluctantly, Nixon appointed Ford because he didn't have the power in Congress. He wanted to appoint either Ronald Reagan or John Connally, the former Texas governor, but congressional Republicans said, "No, we trust Gerry Ford." And they saw the prospect of Nixon having to resign amidst these charges that were brought up around Watergate. And indeed, he did. And Congress and the American people got Gerald Ford as their president.
You talk about his growing up and how he comes, he's the product of a broken marriage. His name comes from his stepfather. He changed his name. He always tried to do the right thing. In World War II, you write about the fact that when he enlisted, he requested duty in a combat zone and earned nine combat medals as a result of that. You talk about him meeting Nixon on his very first day in Congress, and kind of that that kind of weird thing that happened over time, that Nixon was responsible for elevating him ultimately to the presidency, but not through any choice of his own. But given his upright nature and his just human decency, which he seemed to embody throughout his entire life, did we luck out as a nation that he was the guy who ascended to the throne in the wake of Watergate?
Without question, Mike. Absolutely without question. And throughout American history, we have had the great good fortune at crucial times to have in place the right person at the right time. And Gerald Ford is a great example of that. Because he was humble, because he thought about the greater good, he was the right guy. He was very much the antithesis of Nixon. He was open and honest and humble and down to earth. Richard Nixon was very different. I think he had strengths of character. I think he's been vilified. There were good aspects to who he was, but in the wake of the Watergate scandal, which rocked the nation, Gerry Ford was the right guy to take us forward. And again, I think he was very conscious of the fact that he had not been elected by the American people. What he said is, I'm keenly aware, when he was sworn into office, he said, I'm paraphrasing it, but I'm keenly aware that I wasn't elected by your ballots, but I hope to be your president through your prayers. And again, the Americans responded to his leadership, which was very different from that of Richard Nixon. And then again, a month later, he grants the very controversial, but I think much needed in many respects, pardon of Richard Nixon. And that changes things for Gerald Ford politically.
Yeah. You interviewed him late in life. What did he tell you about how he wanted to be remembered?
You know, he was my first presidential interview and the first person I got to know, Mike. It was one of the last interviews he gave. We were at his home in Rancho Mirage, in his cavernous office attached to his home in the desert. But while it was a very large office, he was hard of hearing and it was just the two of us. So he asked me to sit behind the desk with him, and we were sitting so close that our knees were actually touching. And I asked him at the close of the interview, "Mr. President, how do you want to be remembered?" And he said, "Mark, I was a healer and a builder. And if I am to be remembered that way, I would be most grateful." And indeed, a year later when he died, that is exactly how Gerald Ford was remembered, in part because of the politically courageous decision to pardon Richard Nixon.
And that seems to be a common theme through many of the men that you, they've all been men, so I'll say it that way. Of all the men that you talk to for this book, that seems to be a common theme, this humility about how they considered themselves in office and how they wanted to be remembered in most cases.
Yeah, and I think and decent people, and anybody who's a good, decent person who wants to serve their fellow man would feel the weight of that office and try to do everything they could to do the most good for the greatest number of Americans. And I think Gerald Ford felt that.
Gerald Ford's decision to pardon Richard Nixon probably led to his defeat, and that resulted in the presidency of Jimmy Carter, the peanut farmer from Georgia. He had a lot of nicknames, but that was one of them. And despite his education, it made him relatable, I think, to ordinary people. And during the campaign, Jimmy Carter promised to form a government as good as the American people. It's interesting that he would say something that would make us feel so good about ourselves, and later on, be very critical of us as being part of the malaise that America was going through, which I think turned a lot of people against him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so Jimmy Carter campaigned for the presidency in 1976 as a virtual unknown. In fact, so much so that there were buttons that the campaign issued that said, "Jimmy who?" A one-term governor. There was a one-term limit on the governorship of Georgia at the time. So he was a one-term governor of the state of Georgia, little name recognition outside of the state, and battled long odds of being, you know, elected the first president from the Deep South since Zachary Taylor in 1848. But to your point, Mike, he saw that America had gone through the very tempestuous, very turbulent 1960s. We had faced the Watergate scandal, the war in Vietnam, so many things that held us back. And he saw that people looked very cynically at politics, and he took advantage of that by saying, "Look, I'm going to be as good as the American people, and I promise never to lie to you.
Yeah.
And I think, we responded to that. Somebody was very different than the politicians we were used to.
You know, a lot of people pick up the Bible and pound their fists on pulpits and talk about Christianity. This man, Jimmy Carter, was deeply religious. And
yeah.
he practiced the faith that was preached from the pulpits in the churches that he attended. And he practiced what he himself preached as a Sunday school teacher. So he was genuine in his religious belief, and that did guide him, and I think for the better. So how do you sum up his presidency in one of those sentences that you ascribe to these seven men?
You know, I want to go back to what you just said, though. This is somebody who really tried to emulate the life of Jesus Christ, who he called the Prince of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And to that end, he wanted to use the presidency to make a difference in peacemaking and human rights. That's what motivated Jimmy Carter. And indeed, we saw that with the Camp David Accords. Against all odds, he achieved this stunning triumph of bringing Menachem Begin, the prime minister of Israel, and Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, to the bargaining table and negotiating a peace that has lasted since the Camp David Accords were put into place in 1978. That is a stunning accomplishment. And it's a tribute to Jimmy Carter's fierce desire to be a peacemaker and to make a difference in the world. And so that's the sense for Jimmy Carter, that he, you know, that this is somebody who desperately wanted to do good in those areas. And when he's defeated from the presidency, as he is in a landslide when he tries to get reelected in 1980, he devotes his vice presidency, using the weight and the stature of being a former president, to continue to make a difference in those areas through the work of the Carter Center attached to his presidential library in Georgia and the work that he did for Habitat for Humanity.
We don't have time to talk about it because we're out of time in this segment. We'll come back and talk about it because I really do want to focus on that, because when he left office very reluctantly because he wanted to win, but he faced incalculable headwinds because of some things that had happened out of his control, the hostage situation with Iran, which we'll talk about, and kind of how that situation got Ronald Reagan elected. And there might have been some chicanery behind, there was some chicanery behind the scenes that involved all of that, which we will talk about as well with Mark Updegrove, presidential historian and the author of Make Your Mark, Lessons in Character from Seven Presidents. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting author Robin Wall Kimmerer, known for braiding sweetgrass and the service berry, sharing perspectives on Indigenous knowledge and ecology on December 2nd at the Gambrill Center. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about seven presidents who had character, seven lessons in character from those presidents in a book called Make Your Mark. Mark Updegrove is the author. He's the ABC presidential historian and the president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation. Before we're entering the lightning round, because I haven't even scratched the surface on this book and we have limited time left. But I do want to talk about Jimmy Carter a little bit more, because he experienced real highs while he was in office. The Camp David Accords probably being the crowning achievement, but he also had setbacks. He had to deal with rampant inflation and an energy crisis in which we were asked to turn off our lights and turn down the heat and wear sweaters, and he did in the White House, and he turned the lights off all around Washington, D.C. and the monuments at night, and we were tired of that. We sat in gas lines for hours to try to just get a fill-up, not because of him, but just because of stuff that was going on in his presidency, and of course, the Iranian hostage crisis, I think, is what ultimately did him in, because those people were held, American citizens were held by the Iranian government for 444 days. It was the start of the creation of Nightline on ABC because of that, because of the coverage of that. They were freed, these people, minutes into the Reagan presidency, partly due to the efforts of Jimmy Carter, but they were delayed partly due to the efforts we discover later of Mr. Reagan. And that left Jimmy Carter to leave the White House and face what you call unwanted and potentially empty life. And yet that led to the creation of the Carter Center. And when you talked to him late in life, he said he would like to be judged primarily by his work with the Carter Center.
Yeah,
I don't even have a question. Talk about that.
well, I think part of that, Mike, is due to the fact that he had so many more years in his post-presidency than he did in the presidency in order to work toward projects that related to peacemaking and human rights. So through the Carter Center, he monitored the elections in 100 different countries, almost 100 different countries. He helped to alleviate little known but pervasive world diseases in the third world, including river blindness and guinea worm disease. Again, we talked about Habitat for Humanity, which really wasn't part of the Carter Center, but to which he devoted his time. There were 4,400 houses that have been built under the auspices of the Jimmy Carter Work Project, one recently here in Austin, Texas, where I'm talking to you from. So this is a remarkable legacy. So while he was able to accomplish some things during the course of his presidency and had the power of the bully pulpit, he really used his post-presidency to further that agenda. And ultimately, it would yield him the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002.
You accredit his successor, Ronald Reagan, for his optimism and for restoring America's confidence and pride after a series of demoralizing setbacks, many of which occurred during the Carter administration, but also prior to that. He's also credited very often with ending the Cold War. He is famous for going to Berlin and saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. How responsible was he for the end of the Cold War? Was it him? Was it his relationship with Mikhail Gorbachev? They seemed to hit it off pretty well. Or was it simply the crumbling of the Soviet Union's economy?
I think it's the latter more than the former. Look, we give Ronald Reagan credit for ending the Cold War. That's ludicrous. Every president from Harry Truman forward had a stake in the end of the Cold War, as did George H.W. Bush, Reagan's successor. Every president contributed to the ultimate crumbling of the Soviet Union. I once asked Mikhail Gorbachev about that, and it was utterly ludicrous. No one compelled Mikhail Gorbachev to sign the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. But to your point, it was not an economically viable system. And you could see the crumbling of the economy, to your point, Mike. That's really ultimately the undoing of the Soviet Union, that it didn't work as an economic model. But by the same token, Ronald Reagan, in forging a relationship with Mikhail Gorbachev, I think could have expedited the end of the Cold War in a number of different important ways. We have to remember that when Reagan took office, there was great dissension between the Soviet leadership and American presidents. And I think that changed dynamic that Ronald Reagan brought through his relationship with Mikhail Gorbachev was very helpful in the peaceful end to the Cold War.
Of course, Reagan came to us via Hollywood or via the governor's office of California from Hollywood as a result of being a B-movie star, let's put it that way. But he had a folksy sense of humor. He was an accomplished orator. He was able to deliver moving, memorable speeches. But he also had his failures. As you point out, he often ignored inconvenient truths. That sounds familiar, that got in the way of the rosier outlook that he himself had. His time in office was marked by the beginnings of what we've been through now, this corporate greed and homelessness, which has now gotten out of hand, started during his administration. He virtually ignored the HIV/AIDS crisis that began to plague the country. And though it didn't seem like an enormous thing at the time, he was instrumental in the ending of the Fairness Doctrine. That's a broadcast thing. It's fairly arcane for people not in broadcasting, but it led to what we have today, this ecosphere of highly polarized broadcast stations giving one point of view or another with no real fairness toward the other side, which has led to the deep divide that we have in this country. That was not his intention, but it was a result. So given his approach to life and to politics, in which he seemed to be able to meet and talk with anybody, including people on the left, how do you believe he would regard today's politics?
Oh, I think he'd be very disappointed in what's happening. Again, as I mentioned earlier, the policies of Ronald Reagan are antithetical to those of Donald Trump. This is Ronald Reagan was somebody who believed in immigration, knew that that America was built on the backs of immigrants. He believed in free trade. He didn't, we saw that ad that appeared from the province of Ontario during the World Series that had Ronald Reagan talking about tariffs as an enemy to the economy. He didn't believe in that. He believed in free trade. And he believed in promoting democracy throughout the world. These are things that Donald Trump does not believe in. Trump would have, or Ronald Reagan would have hated the autocrats that Donald Trump is obsequious toward.
Let me ask you a quick question about his attitude on tariffs, because there's this big brouhaha that recently occurred between the Canadian governor of one of the provinces in Canada running an ad that
Ontario.
were the words, the speeches of a radio speech from Ronald Reagan, and the Trump administration went crazy because they say they lied about it. I looked at the speech. They may have reordered some sentences, but it did not change the meaning, at least not for me. Ronald Reagan, to be clear, was very against tariffs.
There's no question about that. No, look, they said that it was out of context. No, it was out of order, to your
Right.
point. It was not out of context. The sentiments that were expressed in those parts of the speech that they used in the ad are very much reflective of Donald Trump's anti-tariff stance toward the economy.
We have to talk about the Bushes, both Bushes. I shouldn't lump them together, but for time I will. George H.W. and George W. Bush, they seem like very different men. Were they?
Yeah, different in some respects, but I think they had the same values and many others. I mean, George W. Bush worshipped his father and tried to emulate his father throughout the course of his life. They had slightly different political approaches. Politics had changed by the time that George W. Bush was running for the presidency in 2000. He had to be a whole lot more conservative than his father. I think he was naturally more conservative than his father. He grew up in West Texas. His father had grown up in the Northeast. He was sort of by nature a what we used to call country club Republican. But George W. Bush was a very different strain of Republican, far more conservative than his father.
George H.W. Bush, you write about him, that his approach was part of a broader code, which I guess came from his upbringing. And you have this long quote, which I'm going to read because it's refreshing. And the quote is, "If you win, do so with grace. Don't boast or self-aggrandize. Give credit to others. If you lose, handle it with dignity. Win or lose, extend your hand to your competitor after the game is over. Make a friend if you can." How did we go from George H.W. Bush and that philosophy to where we are as a nation today?
Well, it's hard to know. I'm hopeful that we still have those values. There might be dormant for the time being, at least in our leadership. But I do think that those are core American values, and you can see it. Not only does that he embodies those values, and you can see it in particular when he leaves the Oval Office, which he did with grace. He, like Donald Trump, was defeated for a second term in office when he ran for re-election after his first term. But the letter that he leaves for his successor, Bill Clinton, whom I talked to about that letter, really reflects who George Herbert Walker Bush was.
That letter was left in the Resolute office desk for Bill Clinton on the morning of his inauguration, and it read, "You will be our president." This is from George H.W. Bush. "You will
Yes.
be our president when you receive this note. I wish you well. I wish your family well. Your success is our success. I'm rooting hard for you."
That's
Wow.
exactly right. I mean, that's an amazing thing. Now, Ronald Reagan had started that tradition by leaving a note on the desk for George Bush, but that was a different circumstance. George Bush was Reagan's chosen successor. He had been his loyal vice president for two terms. He was from the same party. His election was not a repudiation of Ronald Reagan. In fact, it was a validation of his presidency. So it was a different circumstance for George Herbert Walker Bush to do that to Bill Clinton. It really reflects the fact that he lived by the creed that he disseminated to his family.
George W. Bush liked to describe himself as a compassionate conservative, and you remind us that in his inaugural address, he told us America at its best is compassionate. Somehow we've lost our way on that as well. And when it comes to W., why did you focus on his giving back to the world, to the country, et cetera, as opposed to his shepherding us through 9/11, the aftermath?
You know, I think you could have chosen that too, because there are a lot of things that that are revealing in his leadership after 9/11. But like Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush is a born-again Christian. Very different politically from Jimmy Carter, but a born-again Christian, and I think lives by the tenet in the Bible that to whom much is given, much is required. And when the AIDS epidemic started ravaging the world, in particular sub-Saharan Africa, where it threatened to wipe out huge swaths of the population, George W. Bush wanted to do something big about it. There is nobody who has given more to the continent of Africa than George W. Bush. A continent and many countries that are of economic inconsequence to the United States. But he saw the AIDS ravaging the parts of the continent and decided to put into place the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, which he gets into policy in 2002. And it made an enormous difference in the world.
I have so many more questions about George W. Bush, but I can't ask them because we only have 4 minutes left, and I want to get to the last two presidents. Bill Clinton. There might be people who are questioning why Bill Clinton would be in a book about presidential character, given what we know about Jennifer Flowers and Monica Lewinsky. But you say that his time is marked by his, quote, resilience and determination to keep working for the American people in the face of political and personal obstacles. Why is that important?
There are two words I would use as a counter. Listen, there's no question about that. He was a womanizer. The Monica Lewinsky chapter of his presidency is disgraceful. But I will say he cared. He cared deeply about bettering the situation that Americans faced in their lives. And he thought deeply about policy. He spent time with Americans, listening to their problems. And it's reflected in the approval ratings throughout the course of his presidency. We see his presidency is a time of unprecedented, sustained economic prosperity. He delivered four consecutive balanced budgets, budget surpluses, in fact. That's a remarkable thing. So even after the Monica Lewinsky impeachment, his approval rating is at an all-time high in his presidency of 72%. Because again, the American people knew that he had flaws. We knew that when we elected him because of Jennifer Flowers and because of the scandals that rocked his governorship. But we saw that he cared about the plight of the American people, and he was doing something about it, particularly in the middle class, Mike.
And finally, Barack Obama. There's more to talk about with Bill Clinton, but we don't have time. He promised to bring hope and change to the country. He did for a while, but you say he also brought grace as the first African-American to hold the office. Both are distinguishing characteristics, but grace is more of a character trait. Was grace what was required when you consider the change that resulted from his elevation to president?
Like, there's no question that as the first African-American president, you had to go into the office with grace. This is somebody who, this is a great leap forward in our country to elect the first Black president. And we talked, I think falsely at the time, about the notion of a post-racial America. Well, that was never going to happen. Race in so many ways defines the very best and the very worst of who we are as a country. And we saw, particularly in the second term of Barack Obama's term in office, that a surge in racism and bigotry. I mean, Donald Trump himself launches his political career by challenging the very notion that Barack Obama is American. We get the whole birther conspiracy, the fact that he wasn't born here, which is ludicrous, but reflected a certain nativism and bigotry that was maybe dormant in our country, but that flared during the latter part of his presidency.
Make Your Mark is not a big book. It's a relatively small book in the scheme of things, but something I think would be refreshing for people to read as a reminder of who we have been in the past and who we should aspire to be in the future, even though we're in a momentary pause, it seems to me, when it comes to character. Mark Updegrove is the author. He's also the CEO of the LBJ Foundation and a presidential historian for ABC News. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.